Hello there, Femi OK and Todd Zwillick with you this morning. Now, the world breathed a sigh of relief yesterday when the captain of the cargo ship Maersk Alabama was rescued unharmed from Somali pirates who had held him hostage for 5 days. Although this is one prominent case and it's over, the crews of about 12 other ships, more than 200 people, are still being held by Somali pirates. That's according to the watchdog group, the International Maritime Bureau. Author and broadcaster Nick Ranking made a three-part documentary on pirates today and historically for the BBC last year. He joins us now from London with a look at the menace of piracy and the hold it continues to have on our imaginations. Nick, hello there. Tell us about your experience with Somali pirates.
Well, I went to Mombasa to make this radio program and I interviewed several captains who'd been captured by Somali pirates and talked to people who knew something about how this whole system worked. And what you've got to understand is that Somalia hasn't had a government for nearly 20 years. Here's a country that has fallen apart in violence. And during that time, because there's been no government, there's been no law, as it were, on the sea. And so people have gone in there fishing illegally and dumping toxic waste. So the piracy kind of began by some Somalis saying, we ought to tax these people coming into our waters. And, of course, the place was full of civil war, awash with weapons and arms. And having no government, being a failed state means what? I mean, these young men, one of them told my friend in Mombasa, he says, look, I've never been to school. I can't read or write. I have no prospects at all. All I have is my courage and this, waving his Kalashnikov. And so what happened was it started up in Puntland, which is the kind of tip of the Horn of Africa. There was a long tradition there of kind of wrecking ships and taxing ships. And basically what they do, it's not stealing the cargo. It's taking people hostage and then getting a ransom. And it's really about getting money. And if people pay, the hostages are given back. Now, in most cases, in pretty well every case I can think of, they haven't harmed the hostages at all. And negotiations take place. This is all happens in the world of the mobile phone. Negotiations take place, money is paid, and then people are freed. But the amount of money that's being earned is huge. If there's a destroyed, failed state with no income, no industry, this becomes a magnet for young men desperate to earn money, like the drug trade or anything like this. It takes men of courage who are desperate for money.
Nick, tell us about the modern technology that the pirates in Somalia are actually using nowadays.
Well, I mean, the point about Somali culture is that essentially it's a warrior culture anyway. If you look at Somali history, these are some of the bravest and most terrifying people on earth. I was reading a book by a man who was in the Second World War in Somalia, and they didn't have a great deal of weapons then, but seven of his comrades in the British administration shot themselves out of horror at what was going on. What's happened is they have modern weapons like rocket-propelled grenades, AK-47s, and the fighting on shore. There's all kinds of weaponry there. But it's the mobile phone and the modern internet. The Somalis, basically an oral culture, have taken to the internet like nobody's business. And the mobile phone is incredible because when they take a ship, and these guys go out in small boats, okay, speed boats, more modern technology. They throw grapnels up and they clamber up, just like guys in the 18th century did, onto the ship. They take the ship and then they get the captain to radio his owners and saying, look, we've taken it. Then, and they give him a mobile phone number and they say, now you negotiate. And negotiations take place. And these are kind of secret, and then the money is delivered by kind of ex-special forces people who work with maritime insurance. And the money's delivered, sometimes by helicopter, parachuted in. And then the people, having been looked after, are freed. But the rich people get freed. It's the poor guys who don't, because maybe they can't muster the ransom. And so poor African sailors are stuck in Bosaso or Hobyo or someplace for months. I met somebody who'd been 3 months rolling in a rust bucket off the coast of Somalia. So it was pretty terrifying. But, you know, with GPS and these phones, people know where they are, and they can get freed.
Well, Nick, we're hearing this morning from some of the remaining pirates that they're vowing revenge for their, I guess, their fallen comrades. They would call them the three that were picked off by Navy snipers earlier today in the rescue of the American cabin. From what you know about these Somali pirates and their bonds with one another, is that a credible threat? Are they loyal enough to one another that they would pick a fight with the U.S. Navy or with anyone else, or are they going to want to start to kill hostages, which is really their currency at this point if it's all about money?
I don't believe they're going to start killing hostages. I mean, they'll stand up for a fight. I mean, the point is, it's like warrior's honor, isn't it? The U.S. Marines say, you know, no man left behind. I mean, it's interesting to look at your own military. The U.S. Marines why do they go to the shores of Tripoli? What were they doing in 1803? They were going to rescue an American ship that had been captured by Barbary pirates. So this problem is going on for 200 years. And like any warrior, you know, if someone challenges you, kills your mates, you're going to stand up and shout about it. I don't necessarily think they're going to start killing hostages, because that's killing the golden goose. I mean,
right.
There is no point in doing that.
It's
but
the currency.
They will stand up and fight, though.
Nick, there's always, when we mention the word pirates, there's certain images that come to mind, even as we're following events off the coast of Mombasa, the coast of Somalia. Let me just take a little pause here and bring in Mr. Orson Welles.
Nothing charms, nothing ingratiates, nothing wins like a one-legged, double-barreled buccaneer with earrings, a handkerchief on his head, and a knife in his teeth. What could be more appropriate on the starboard rail of your four-masted brigantine? If you haven't a four-masted brigantine, you have Treasure Island. In your library because it's a great English classic, and this evening because it's a great story, it's on your radio.
So in your study of pirates, you not only looked at contemporary pirates, you looked at historical ones too, and then also where fiction comes into play. Tell us about the influence that fiction has on us in terms of our view and imagination and the way we think about pirates.
I love that extract you've played. It's Orson Welles' Mercury Theatre of the Air's adaptation in 1938 of Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. What you have to understand about piracy is that the Romantics took over this as soon as it began to die out. When the Barbary pirates or corsairs were destroyed, within years, Lord Byron wrote his poem The Corsair, romanticising them. This sold 10,000 copies in a day. Stevenson's book Treasure Island, written in 1883, begins, "I take up my pen in the year 17, whatever.
Oh, yes, I remember that line.
Because it's 100 years ago. It's 100 years ago, it's dead, it's past. And that book, Treasure Island, is a marvellous thing, because what is it about? It's about money. There's two groups of people. It's called Treasure Island. They're after money. There's two groups. The gentleman born, the captain, the squire, the doctor, they want to confirm their status by getting this money. And then there are the gentlemen of fortune, these ragged, scarred men on the outside who want to get some status. I mean, Silver wants to be an MP. He says, "I should be rolling in a coach instead of sponging for a drain of rum." They are desperate for the money. And this is what it's about.
Nick, I want you to do a little bit of myth-busting for us, because we're coming close to our wrapping up time here. So you, in your extensive research of pirates, there are a couple of myths that you busted. Did pirates really maroon people on desert islands, yes or no?
Yes, I think they did. That's certainly true. Some of them had wooden legs because they were in combat. They were scarred. Lots of them had parrots, things like that. They didn't really bury treasure. They went and spent it. That's the whole point. On girls and grog and gambling. That's what pirates did. Their lives were nasty, brutish and short. They were violent. They've become symbols of freedom now, and now we have all these people who steal things on the internet and call it piracy. It's still robbery, but we've romanticized it by saying they're against the system. And it's true that the pirates were egalitarian and they did have their own rules outside the system, but they were also seen as the enemies of all mankind, which is why international law pursues them and will pursue these pirates now.
Two quick things I have to ask you. First one is, what part did the US Navy have in destroying the pirate trade?
Well, I think that if you go back to look at that early history in the Mediterranean, there was a kidnapping of a ship and the U.S. Navy was first formed. I think it was, I can't remember who the president was. Was it Jackson? Was it Jefferson? I can't remember. At the beginning of the 19th century, and the U.S. forces went in there to help destroy the Barbary corsairs, who basically worked out of Algiers and had done for centuries, raging across the Mediterranean, kidnapping people, putting them in slavery. Cervantes, the author of Don Quixote, was captured by pirates. Pirates in the Mediterranean went back to Greek and Roman times.
Nick Rankin, sorry, we've run out of time.
Goodbye!
There you go. Author and broadcaster Nick Rankin, thank you very much.
You can email us.